Welcome to Fire on the Prairie, the radio show brought to you by In These Times magazine. I'm Aaron Sarver.
And I'm Emily Udell. On this show, you'll hear an interview with poet Kevin Koval.
Hip-hop was radically literate and radically intelligent, and so it made me want to learn. I mean, that's what was cool in 88, was knowledge. Knowledge, like Kumu D said, was king.
Koval is co-founder of the Chicago Teen Poetry Festival. His first book, Slingshots, A Hip-Hop Poetica, was released late last year.
We also have a conversation with Christina Page, author of the new book, How the Pro-Choice Movement Saved America.
And finally, you'll hear an excerpt from a discussion with Chicago Sun-Times publisher John Cruikshank.
First, a conversation with Kevin Koval. Kevin Koval is co-founder of Louder Than a Bomb, the largest youth poetry slam in the country. The sixth annual slam will happen this March in Chicago. Aaron Sarver recently spoke with Koval about his introduction to hip-hop and how it led him to advocate for youth literacy through hip-hop.
When did things first click for you? When did you know this was something you were going to pursue?
So 82 is kind of my first, I would say, hip-hop memories, but you know, I immersed myself in it later, you know, in that kind of second wave of hip-hop supergroups, you know, some people call the golden era, like 88 to 92, and that's pretty much when I was in high school. And so I started writing in high school because I started reading so much because hip-hop was telling me to read and really pushing me into the libraries, groups like Boogie Down Productions and KRS-One and Public Enemy and Chuck D and X-Clan and the Native Tongue Posse, like the Tribe Called Quest. I mean, all these guys would drop a lot of names, like historical figures in their rhymes, and I don't really know who they were, so I would kind of rush to the library to read who Assata Shakur was or who the Black Panthers were. Or the information I was reading in the libraries and I was hearing in the rhymes, I would inevitably would end up in my essays or papers or book reports to my high school. So I started to kind of write battle rhymes to my high school English teachers, because who and what we were studying was so white and narrow and European, and what I was listening to on my own was so Afrocentric and Black nationalist that the two inevitably met head to head in this confrontational manner. And I knew and thought that what I was listening to out of the mouths of these teachers like KRS and Chuck D was much more profound and interesting and important and historically accurate than these kind of white lies I was getting into my classroom. So I think I started writing then, and the reaction I would get especially, and that confrontation that it would create in my classroom, I thought that I was onto something.
So initially hip-hop was just an avenue for you to explore things you otherwise wouldn't encounter?
Yeah, I mean, I think it opened up a lot of doors, like anything. And I chose to walk through some as opposed to walking through others. Like, some people are exposed to and participate in hip-hop and walk through a door of gangsterism or hyper-materialism. But at the time I was listening to, especially, hip-hop was radically literate and radically intelligent. And so it made me want to learn. I mean, that's what was cool in 88, was knowledge. Knowledge, like Kumu D said, was king. And so that's what I wanted to then do. I wanted to be smart.
You have a track on the CD called Elegy to Lit X. What did that space mean to you?
Lit X was this space that I kind of almost dreamed about, you know, and never knew that spaces like it actually existed. It was an Afrocentric bookstore, you know, run by people who were extremely well-read, knew the different canonical traditions that they were participating in the diaspora of Black literature, and saw themselves as next in line in that movement, next in line as, you know, just a progression in the history of storytelling. So they gathered like a religious movement on Saturday nights, and spoke and prayed and sung, and it was, you know, it was brilliant. At the time especially, I was primarily writing by myself, for myself, and not didn't really know that there was this world of orality in Chicago and around the country and really around the world. And so seeing that, just it opened me up to the possibility of what the word can do when in communion with others.
Hip-hop often tells stories that counter the dominant myths of our time. How do you think that influenced your thinking and writing?
If hip-hop, and the hip-hop I was getting primarily from New York, was about, you know, working class narratives, then I felt resonance with those working class narratives because I saw my mom and my dad, you know, struggle in a similar capitalist system for different reasons that other people were articulating. I mean, Chuck D comes from Long Island and so does De La Soul, so they're black suburban kids, but they're still talking about a similar economic system where they saw their parents work and struggle and treat them at times unjustly. And so there was real resonance for me in that. And I eventually learned then that's the story that I have to tell. It's interesting now, being a teacher and doing workshops in city schools and suburban schools, and a lot of times suburban kids feel like they don't have stories to tell. And so a lot of what we do is try to talk about deconstructing that myth of the American dream, or the fruition of the American dream, and just trying to analyze. And if we can tell then another side of it, isn't there an importance in that storytelling?
How did you deal with issues of appropriation in hip-hop? This has been an issue with white people participating in black cultural art forms for a long time.
I feel that I and other white folks can use it if they speak honestly or represent honestly who they are and where they come from. I don't think that there have been white innovators within the form, and I don't think it's a white form. But I also think what I learned about hip-hop, or what I learned from hip-hop early, is that it was about the skill and craft and not necessarily about what you looked like. Hip-hoppers especially, not American as a dominant culture, because we have all sorts of kind of Elvises within hip-hop as well. You know, I think that hip-hop kids know the difference between who and what is real, and are they, you know, genuinely participating and representing and storytelling and crafting their skill, whether it be, you know, b-boying or graffiti or rhyming. I think hip-hop at least opens a real, you know, progressive discussion, or has the ability to open up a progressive discussion about what is appropriate and what's appropriated.
It seems like hip-hop and Judaism have come full circle for you. What are the common elements between the two?
For me, I think that there was something always about this orality and storytelling. So if I was, you know, at the time I was studying for my bar mitzvah, I would be trying to memorize my Haftorah portion because I hated Hebrew school and I was forced to memorize it so I could get through it and learn it. I would listen to old tapes of cantors chanting, and there was a rhythm there that wasn't dissimilar to some of the rhythm I was hearing in hip-hop. And then the stories that I got from my dad, my aunt, and other family members about, where my family comes from in Russia, and kind of having to leave the Cossacks, and, you know, trying to get to this country in order to not be killed when they came through, you know, their township in Russia and the Ukraine. And there was something about that I always liked, you know, all of the humor, the heartache, the beauty, the brutality, all within the same story that I felt also was present within hip-hop. One of the things that I felt hip-hop demanded from me was that I deal with Judaism, and that ideal, especially as I began to find out more and more, and especially after the first intifada, but particularly I think I was struck after the second intifada, that hip-hop demanded that I deal with Israel-Palestine as an issue, because it's an issue within my community, and if I didn't talk about it, it would be disingenuous. I would be the Jewish kid at the table who refuses to acknowledge a situation that is prominent in the minds of many people, not only within hip-hop, but also around the world.
You're listening to Fire on the Prairie. What follows is Kevin Koval reading a piece from his new book, Slingshots, a Hip-Hop Poetica.
Underground Chi-Town battle rap for a dying Zionist. Old man, you jock Republicans like barnacles,
Reaganomic sacks packed in your mouth like clowns by the carloads. I hope your heart holds more space than trucks and United Parcel. You sold the star skyward to the highest Goliath barcode. Hashem's sparks froze. Now King David throws rocks with slingshots from the golden heights of idols. Resurrect flack hikes like a Renton Goldman around the riot pole. We suppose those chose rock sandals and halos, but you arm guard the ark with handguns and frayed souls. I'm afraid those gates close on Moses' five books won't be opened by idiot boxing rabbis posing grateful as paid rooks. Don't we find it odd the evangelical is our bedfellow? We wallow in tasty pig cakes, claiming we never had trouble. But best believe when I see Jerry Falwell on TV, I guess what he's thinking. Give money to Satan's children till the Lord comes back to beseech them. 144,000 doesn't mean you, Jew. We lost in the house of Babel, backing the fork-tongued and feeble-minded liars, hypocrite Holocaust deniers. The Middle East is an oil field. Israel could be set on fire as long as corporate shields protect the safe through muck and mire. The Middle East is an oil field. Israel could be set on fire as long as corporate shields protect the saved.
Hip-hop is a form of expression that's often more accessible than what high school kids encounter in the classroom. Can you talk about your work with young Chicago authors and how you try to bridge the gap between the two?
If we want to teach literacy, if we want to teach an appreciation for literature, and we start with John Donne, or if we start with Robert Frost or Edgar Allan Poe, I think a lot of times we're going to lose most kids who are savvy and learned in what they know. Hip-hop, I think, you know, was Frarian before a lot of us even read Frary, because it dealt with what was around us immediately, and it used that then as a starting point to go backwards, whether it be backwards into the canon of African literature or the canon of social, economic American history, or the canon of religion in some ways. And so if students in the classroom right now know every word to Young Jeezy or Pac or Big or Nas or Jay-Z or whoever it is, I feel like that is an excellent starting point then to have a conversation about literature or kick off a social studies class, because they know so much right now. The kids who go to the Chicago public schools and who drop out at a rate of 1 to 2, and who, you know, who graduate at a rate of 1 to 4, and who go to college at a rate of, you know, like 1 to 6, right? So the Chicago public schools are failing miserably, you know, because part of the reason is that we don't access the students' base of knowledge. If we have conversations about the prison industrial complex, if we have conversations about globalization, post-industrialization, gentrification, and police brutality, and all of these issues that are in the music that they're listening to right now, and in the lives, more importantly, of the students who are in the Chicago public school system right now, then I think we can have a progressive education system that demands an engaged student.
Well, thanks for talking with me, and we'll end with you performing another piece from the book.
Disconnect, 1984 and the Failure of Education, or CPS Gets an F, You. What you reading, Joe? This book sucks, dog. Two boys banter on the Orange Line West. Vocational high school English teachers assigned Orwell's classic. I gotta write about this dude being watched. For real? Salesmen head back to New England via Midway, hold laptop leather bags closer on creased khakis. The boys exit at Pulaski, 55 years after the book first dropped. What you gonna write about? I don't even know. Blue lightbox video recorders hover over street lamp corners like spaceships. Aliens in the hood, Big Brother in blue is white, always watching.
You just heard an interview with poet Kevin Koval. To find out more about the Louder Than a Bomb Poetry Slam, visit youngchicagoauthors.org.
The Chicago Sun-Times is one of the two major daily papers in Chicago. It is part of Hollinger International, which owns more than 400 newspapers worldwide. Community Media Workshop President Tom Clark recently sat down with Sun-Times publisher John Cruikshank for a public Q&A about the future of newspaper publishing. What follows is an excerpt from the discussion. Clark is asking questions that were submitted by the audience.
What do you think is the most underreported story in Chicagoland, and what needs to happen to get it better reported? I'm not expecting you to disclose your next investigation.
You know, I don't have an answer for that. I do believe that the public housing story is a tremendously important one and very much underreported. I do think it gives entrance to a whole world of poverty and powerlessness that most media find kind of unappealing. There is no television story in public housing. There's no radio story in public housing, you know, but for PBS. I think there's an awful lot there. But, you know, there are so many nominations. I'm not sure anybody would have known a couple of years ago before you know, a member of our newsroom started in on veterans issues, that there were, you know, tremendous issues about the treatment of our veterans that needed to be exposed and solved. So, you know, that's just one. And I think we all have an intuitive sense of, you know, there are lots of others out there.
I want to suggest that the public housing transformation we might look back on as our Katrina. Mm-hmm. And that as journalists, we missed a lot of stories as people go through a transformation of some kind. And a lot of those folks are dispersed, and we've now lost those stories, notwithstanding what's happening to their families and their households.
Yeah, but we haven't lost all those stories, because I know I've read a lot of those stories, and I know that the glimmering of awareness and sense of concern and even guilt that some of us have has continued to be tweaked by stories that have been done, certainly at the Sun-Times, and indeed in some of the other media as well.
Yeah. Another columnist question. Why do you choose to run Bill O'Reilly's column? I don't care about the political orientation, but journalistic integrity. Doesn't he take credibility away from the Sun-Times' rich op-ed columnists?
I'm not even sure how often we run O'Reilly. Or if we're still running O'Reilly, so he's not a big presence in the Sun-Times in my mind. Why would you run him at all? For diversity, you know, to a certain extent for sex appeal. You know, he's a name, and he may draw some folks to a page that they might not otherwise come to. I don't think he's in any way a kind of dominating voice on our op-ed page. I think you get a pretty broad spectrum there, as you do in the controversy section that we run on with the Sunday paper.
That was Sun-Times publisher John Cruikshank talking with Tom Clark of the Chicago-based Community Media Workshop.
Christina Page is the Vice President of the Institute for Reproductive Health Access of NARAL Pro-Choice New York. She has also worked on the editorial staffs of Glamour and Ms. magazines. In these times, Assistant Editor Phoebe Connolly sat down with Page to discuss her new book, How the Pro-Choice Movement Saved America, Freedom, Politics, and the War on Sex.
In your book, you write about Griswold versus Connecticut. Would you talk about this case and why it was so important for the pro-choice movement?
I believe that Griswold was 65. There were many states that had already legalized the use of contraception for married couples. Griswold made it a federal, you know, right. It was immediately followed by the introduction of the pill, really, by and large. And the impact of that is so dramatic in the last 30 years. It's been a 40-year journey now, and we've only begun to take stock of its impact. But Harvard researchers recently just looked at the power of the pill on American culture. And what it found was it was in direct relationship to women flooding into colleges, flooding into the workplace, flooding into the professions, what this has done is it's had a dramatic impact on family financial stability. The rate of poverty in our country has declined by half since the introduction of family planning. Where you both person in the couple is working, you have two-thirds higher income than where just the husband works. And now children are living in families that are wealthier, and this has had a real impact on and benefit to the child. It's also true of divorce rates. You know, families that are wealthier are less likely to have to divorce. Really, all of the pro-family goals that we hear so much of from the Christian right are being realized not through any evangelical talk, but through giving people the right to plan the families to the size that they can manage and support and that they want, and that these are leading to the outcomes that are really creating stronger families, stronger men in families. You know, what we haven't really discussed is the liberation of men as it's been from this. Right now, we're seeing a father that's never existed before in history. He spends much more time with his child, is much more affectionate. And that's because he's not solely the breadwinner. There's been much more balance in the family, and children are benefiting wildly as a result of it.
Staying on this theme of contraception, right now there's definitely an urban-rural split as far as access mm-hmm. to contraception. And I was curious to see what your thoughts on that, especially moving forward as there are increasingly restrictions and limitations on women's access to
right.
their ability to pay for
right. I mean,
contraception.
There is a very big divide here. I mean, rural women, by and large, rely on pharmacies like Walmart, for example. Walmart right now won't fill prescriptions for emergency contraception, which has the promise of reducing the nation's abortion rate by 50%. I think this is a very pro-abortion policy on Walmart's part. But really what it means for rural women, you know, Walmart is their major pharmacy there. And so even if they're turned away from one, it means that they have to try to find another, you know, and drive another 30 or 40 miles to get a prescription filled. This really, you know, translates into a barrier for a woman who's eager to prevent abortion, eager to make sure that this isn't something that she has to confront. And in those cases, when Walmart and all these other, you know, people who are obstructing her right to prevent pregnancy get involved, then if she indeed needs an abortion, you know, she doesn't have anywhere locally. It's this crazy web that she has to extract herself from. And so it means raising the money to get and take time off of work to get to a locality or city that offers it. What that also means is it's delays for her. The pro-life movement may talk a good game about wanting to prevent late-term abortion, but many of their policies are leading to them. This is riskier for women. I mean, the earlier in a pregnancy a woman can access this care, the safer it is for her. The complications rise dramatically with each gestational stage.
So speaking of local and state laws that are preventing access, within the progressive movement, there's a talk about taking progressive policies and trying to enact them at the state level. But that's where the successful battlegrounds for Democrats, for progressives, that's where it's going to happen. Do you think that's true of the reproductive movement as well?
No doubt about it. When it comes to the pro-choice approach, absolutely, it has to happen on the local level. You know, we've seen these victories. We've seen contraceptive coverage bills. Now, we don't have a federal contraceptive coverage bill, and that's thanks to pro-lifers. But we do have it in 21 states, and that's thanks to pro-choicers. History has shown us that the federal system works at a much slower pace than the state system. And so as we move forward and in protecting these rights, states have to codify Roe. They have to put it in their state constitution and make sure that, you know, the privacy laws in their state include the privacy of a person's body, that they get to choose what they can do with their body, and that's the interpretation of that privacy law. The local level, this is where the pro-choice movement is going to become very active, making sure that women have access to the most effective pregnancy prevention methods, and whether it be emergency contraception or continuing to fight for health insurers to cover contraception, but also making sure that doctors are trained in the best and most modern and earliest abortion techniques. One of the looming and gathering threats in our country is that our doctors no longer have access to training. And that's because abortions typically are not happening in hospitals. They're happening in private clinics where doctors don't rotate. And so we're seeing a majority of physicians who want to offer comprehensive care, including abortion care to their patients, but they're leaving their residency program with no training, and so therefore don't provide. For example, Michael Bloomberg in New York City just led an initiative to make sure that physicians rotating through the public hospitals there have access to the earliest and most modern techniques, and that women who need services through the public hospitals are getting it in the highest quality as women with means who are able to access care through clinics or through their private physicians.
You brought up the right to privacy, because that's sort of what Roe v. Wade hinges on. What are the other ramifications for women if that's how Roe v. Wade is struck down?
Yeah, exactly. You know, Roe is built on a pillar in which it's basically the tree trunk is Roe, and the roots of that tree are Griswold. In some ways, they have a trifecta, because important gay rights are built on the same privacy rights. So, you know, they get to strike down abortion. They call into question Lawrence v. Texas, which was built on Roe. They call into question the very nature of Griswold. You know, if you can say that a woman has a right to use contraception because she has the right to determine what happens to her in her body, and that right isn't true with abortion, it automatically draws into question whether or not Griswold is constitutionally protected.
There's so much self-examination going on. You know, is there a third wave feminism? Is there not a third wave feminism? Where do you think reproductive rights and the fight for reproductive rights fits into a reinvigorated movement?
Oh, it's essential. I don't think the women's movement could have existed without reproductive rights. I mean, certainly that's the first fight. Mm-hmm. I think what will happen is we will see the impact of stripping women of their reproductive rights. I think women will not be able to go to college. I think that, you know, we're going to see it all unravel from there in the same way in which all those things were built on these rights. The women's movement, as for whether or not there's a third wave, absolutely. I don't think that we can even classify it as a third wave, though. I mean, you know, was Alice Paul the third wave for suffrage? I think they were fighting the same fight. I don't see it any different. We're still fighting for childcare. We're still fighting for birth control. Sure, I mean, maybe just a new generation grabbing the torch, and if we want to rename it, that's fine. But it's the same battle. I mean, in some ways, it's no different. The first wave of feminism was suffrage. The second wave of feminism is this. We may need a kick in the pants, absolutely. I think we've become very complacent in our liberties. But I also really feel like we've done ourselves a disservice from separating these rights from men. Men have benefited by the right to family planning. Men have benefited by being able to have intellectual equals as marriage partners. Women who are bringing home equal amounts in income for the family. They've also been given the right to become more involved parents. We need to expose the hypocrisy now and get real about the facts of what are going on and not be really afraid to fight for these rights.
You just heard an interview with Christina Page, author of How the Pro-Choice Movement Saved America. For more information on the book, visit prochoicemovement.com.
Thanks for joining us for Fire on the Prairie, the radio show sponsored by In These Times magazine. Visit In These Times on the web at inthesetimes.com.
Fire on the Prairie is produced by Aaron Sarver and Emily Udell in Chicago. Sign up for our podcasts at our website, fireontheprairie.com.
Join us again next month for Fire on the Prairie.